Welcome to Breakdown. I'm Charles Ames. Today we'll talk with Washington 10th Legislative District Representative Marilyn Strickland. I'll ask her about the new Speaker of the House and what are the odds that this will contribute to a federal shutdown. And we'll talk about preventing another January 6th. And finally, I'll ask her what is being done about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Next, in Both Sides Now, we'll have a debate about term limits. And then I'll finish with a discussion on immigration. That's coming up now in Breakdown. Let's roll. This is Charles Ames for KTAH-FM. I'm speaking today with Representative Marilyn Strickland. She represents the 10th Congressional District, much of South Puget Sound. She's a member of the House Armed Services Committee and the Transportation Infrastructure Committee and co-chair of the Puget Sound Recovery Caucus. Thank you for this opportunity, Congresswoman Strickland.
Well, thank you for having me and hello to all the listeners.
It's raining today, but 60 degrees. It looks like things are getting back to normal. I'd like to get right into the questions. I want to ask, does having this new speaker, Mike Johnson, increase the likelihood of a shutdown? This is a profoundly important concern to the thousands of people that work on JBLM.
Well, thank you for that question. And I want to go back a bit with your listeners. So we swore in a new Speaker of the House in January, and that's because the Republicans took the majority, which means they have about a 4 or 5 vote margin in the majority. And Kevin McCarthy served until the end of September until he got the boot. And he got the boot, Charles, because he agreed to a provision called a motion to vacate, where one member of his caucus could bring forth to the floor a motion to fire him. 8 Republicans voted to fire him. And I think that's really important to make this abundantly clear. This was not the Democrats did this. This is something that the Republicans did. So after that, they had to find a new speaker. So they have cycled through Steve Scalise, Tom Emmert, Jim Jordan, and finally we landed on Mike Johnson. And to be honest with you, I think this is pretty true for a lot of people who haven't been in caucus for a long time. I had to Google him. I did not know who this gentleman was. He's from Louisiana. And as we get to know more about him, he is definitely an fundamentalist evangelical. So as we look at who has the gavel now, I think the question becomes, will the Republican caucus be functional enough to bring forward a resolution that will keep government open? And I say this because last time when we passed something that will expire in mid-November, it took 209 Democrats, along with 140 Republicans, to vote yes to keep government open. And the Republicans who voted for that were punished along with Speaker McCarthy. So long story short, I am hopeful that we will not have another government shutdown because, as you mentioned, it will be catastrophic to our community. It will affect service members. It will affect senior citizens. It will affect local and state governments' ability to do their work as well. So I tell folks I remain an optimist, but in order for us to keep government open, it will require a bipartisan solution. And I don't know that the GOP is up for that. And one more thing I want to say too, as a member of the House Democratic Caucus, I will always work across the aisle to find common ground where it's possible. What I won't do is compromise my values. And so we want to work in a bipartisan way, but I don't know if the GOP is up for that.
I'm hopeful that it's a good sign that 217 GOP representatives saw something of value in there. What happens remains to be seen. I'd like to ask you, 3 years ago, we came perilously close to losing democracy. And so I'm wondering, shouldn't we hold GOP co-conspirators accountable?
So we came dangerously close to losing democracy because Joe Biden won the presidential election. It was certified by every single Secretary of State across the country, both Republicans and Democrats. And then there was an attempt to basically stage a coup and overturn the results of the election. And by the way, Mike Johnson, who has the gavel right now, he was one of the lead architects in the legal argument to overturn the election. With that said, there have been people who had stormed the Capitol, trying to do harm to people, who are being tried just about every day. We know that there are probably people who are part of the GOP who had some role in it. Jim Jordan did, Michael Johnson did. And so holding people accountable is a little challenging when you're not in the majority. But as we look at the future election in 2024, we have to make sure a few things happen. Number one, that we have safeguards in place that do not allow this to happen again, where people are challenging the results of a legitimate election, making sure that every state has protection so that people's votes are in fact counted and the certification process continues to be legitimate, but also being mindfully aware of it. You know, one of my concerns with both Jim Jordan and with Mike Johnson are that they were insurrectionists and they were election deniers. And so I worry that if there's an outcome that Donald Trump doesn't want in 2024 or doesn't like, will there be another attempt to stage a coup and to overturn the election? But I tell folks the best way to do this is to win resoundingly, and to make sure people understand what is at stake in the election cycle in 2024.
It seems pretty obvious to the average voter that that should be a case. All right, let's keep moving on. I wanted to ask, in the case of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, he's been implicated in several ethical misconducts. How should Congress handle this?
So anyone who engages in wrongdoing or takes advantage of their position should be held accountable. And there are two parts to this, because there's the role of his wife, Ginny, in the January 6th insurrection. She had a very, very heavy hand in that. And then on top of that, there is a Supreme Court Ethics Act, which is going to form a judicial code of conduct for Supreme Court justices. And so, you know, this has been in the news. We've talked about what we can do about it, but I come back to, and this is not an excuse, but you hear me say this a lot, with a Republican majority, it makes things difficult, but there should be a code of conduct. And the highest court in the land, at a minimum, should be held to this standard. I think the other thing that's important to recognize too, though, if the person at the top of your party and ticket is a known criminal who is engaging in all kinds of scandalous behavior, who is now under indictment, who is sitting in court, who has his family members and different people testifying against him, it makes it hard to do the right thing because you're accepting it at the highest level. However, I do believe in due process. And I think as things unfold over time, Donald Trump will be held accountable and so will Clarence Thomas. But I think the conversation becomes, you know, at what point has this bad behavior become so normalized that we don't even flinch anymore when it happens?
I'm flabbergasted. You're right on the money, and I really appreciate your frankness on that matter. It does seem to be fairly straightforward that there should be a universal understanding when it comes to representing the people, although in the case of the Supreme Court. All right, I'm a little bit ahead of time. Now, I did want to kind of back up a little bit and point out that our grandparents complained in their day about things that they thought were monumental. But now, compared to current issues, their issues seem mild. Is there any chance we may ever return to normalcy, or is this the new normal?
So, you know, I talked to folks who have been in Congress for a long time, for decades, and they have seen a lot. And even when Mike Johnson was getting sworn in as speaker, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, who's the minority leader, the leader of the Democrats, referred back to American history. He talked about the Civil War. He talked about the Great Depression. And he talked about America always finding a way to right itself and correct itself. So as a person who chooses to be here every 2 years because I continue to want to serve, I have to remain optimistic. But the reality, Chaz, is that we are in a situation in this country and around the world, honestly, where we are more divided than ever. And I believe there are two reasons for that. And one of them, social media has made it very, very hard to govern. And I say that in the context of when I was growing up, or even when I started in politics back in the mid-2000s, you got your news from three sources: the television, print, or radio. Now with social media and all these different platforms, it is so easy to be fed a steady diet of garbage. It is easy to be fed things that are not true. And it's easy to engage in what I call confirmation bias, because you may have a certain set of beliefs and someone may want to talk to you about a different perspective. And instead of engaging in a nuanced conversation, social media algorithms manipulate you into going to people you only agree with or people you vehemently disagree with. And so I love social media for how it is disseminated information and reunited people and helps you communicate. But at the same time, there are things that happen in that on those platforms that just undermines democracy and our ability to be united instead of divided. With that said, in Congress, there are times when we do come together, but I sometimes deeply worry about the divisions that we have, not just in America, but around the world. And how do we find a way to come together? How do we get away from this move of authoritarian governments where you have strong men, it's a very gendered term, but strong men just coming in, doing what they want. Donald Trump, by the way, falls into that category. And I just think about the fact that this is why democracy is so fragile, and this is why we have to be present. And one of the things I talk about all the time is we cannot sleep on local elections. This year, there are important elections taking place, school board, city council, and all these local races are often the bench to build leaders to go into other offices. And so every election is so incredibly important. But as far as division goes, I tell people, stand by your values. And if there's someone who's willing to engage you with a different perspective, have the grace to listen to them, even if you disagree, because I tell folks, policymaking is about nuance. It's about listening. And when you get the best policy, it's because you've taken all perspectives into account, not something that's crazy and, crazy and against our values, but just giving each other grace to listen to someone else's perspective that may be a little different from yours. I just think we don't do that enough. So I'm hoping that we can try to bridge these divides, but we live in a changing world and a changing country. So with more different opinions, you're going to have more division sometimes.
Thank you very much. Well thought out and all comprehensive. I appreciate that. All right. With a few seconds we have remaining, Congresswoman, is there any final word, anything you'd like to leave us with?
Yes, to all of your listeners, and you've heard me speak, for a few minutes about things. And yes, democracy is in danger right now, and that is not an over-exaggeration. We must show up and vote in every election and take it seriously. And even with some of the outcomes of previous elections, if people who didn't show up showed up, we could have gotten a better outcome. And what I tell folks is, sitting out an election is handing a vote to the people you oppose. So make it an important priority to vote in every single election. The other thing I would say too is, we're having challenges right now in the United States and around the world, but we have to make sure that we stay vigilant and we don't lose sight of what this country is supposed to represent. It's a place that is opportunity for all people. It's where people are treated with respect and dignity, regardless of where they come from, who they love, or what their affiliation is. And so we have to get back to those base values and ideals of what this country is supposed to be. It's not going to be easy because change is never easy, but we have to evolve to have a place that is more safe, more just, more secure, and more importantly, more inclusive.
Thank you very much, Representative Marilyn Strickland, 10th Congressional District.
Thank you for having me.
This is Charles Ames with Both Sides Now. I'm talking with Dr. Phil Kiever. Dr. Kiever is recently a Spokane conservative radio host. He's a keynote speaker of prominence at Liberty University, the Reagan Library, and hundreds of other speaking engagements where he is the keynote speaker. He is also re-releasing his book, 182 Days in Iraq. So welcome aboard, Dr. Kiever.
And I also had a conversation once with a notable professor from the University of Toronto, and I showed her a video of my Holstein steer eating strawberries. And rather sheepishly,
is that a euphemism?
She asked me if that's where strawberry milk came from. For those of you listening in Rio Linda, it was a video of my Holstein steer eating strawberries, and she asked if that's where strawberry milk came from. We're going to talk about term limits, and I'm taking a position that may not be mainstream conservatism, but hopefully by the end of my rant, you will see that, wow, that is a very conservative position, and we should adopt that. So statistically, right now, the average tenure of a congressman or woman is very close to 9 years, and the tenure of a senator, man or woman, is around 11 years, which is kind of odd because that, you know, two terms is 12 years because each term is six. So, you know, they must be accounting for people who retire and, you know, become president of the University of Florida. I'm talking to you, Ben Sasse from Nebraska. So arguments against term limits, I've kind of come up with the following. In the 200 years of our past, if you went to Washington, D.C. to serve, you didn't take your family with you. You didn't maintain a residence in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. I'm talking to you, Senator Feinstein. May you rest in peace. You didn't allow your wife to become the president of the PTA in Fairfax, Virginia. You, you know, didn't send your kids to private schools in Washington, D.C. I'm talking to you, Senator Obama, before you did have your residence there at the White House. Congressmen and women used to live in boarding houses. It was very uncomfortable. It was also a lot cheaper. More work was done. They worked in a more cooperative manner because you were living, you know, with roommates, just like sports teams do. And the summer recess was the summer recess. You went home. You were a gentleman farmer. You were a gentleman business owner, or you were a gentlewoman business owner. Now that we're in this century, also you had a whole nother career. This term career politicians, has really just become a talking point for people who want there to be term limits. And, having term limits, it's a lazy way. People feel like that, well, I don't have to go out and vote. If there were term limits, we would just get new people. And there is something to be said for allowing people continuing to vote for your representative or your senator, because you do get an institutional knowledge. Tip O'Neill, Robert Byrd, Strom Thurmond. I'll even throw in, Chuckie Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Tom Foley, George Nethercutt, who ran on term limits from the 5th District in Washington State and was my congressional representative. And then he threw term limits out the window because he liked what he was doing. We don't need term limits. We can just make them go home and really not allow our representatives to maintain residences and domiciles outside of the state that they represent. And I really think that will cause folks to, represent their state, Nebraska, Florida, Colorado, in a much more vociferous way. If their family is still residing there and they really are representing the interests of their constituents, because they are going home every weekend, they're not just going back to, their residence in Manassas, Virginia, or Aberdeen, Maryland, or wherever they may be. So overall, I just think it's a lazy thing that that people could be like, well, they're just going to be term limited out. What say you?
You need me here for this argument, Phil? You're giving both sides of the issue.
I'm sorry. I get excited.
You get excited about, and I'm getting a little bit of whiplash here. You are for term limits.
No, I am against term limits.
You're against term limits. And so people can become career politicians and lose touch with their constituency.
If they are allowed to maintain a residence, I think they should have to go home. Run as many times as you want. Get that institutional knowledge if you want. But I do not think that we should have a constitutional amendment that puts term limits in place. It should be up to the voter. I will not do both sides. Okay. I am against term limits. And the reasons that I am against term limits is it allows the voter to be lazy. You lose institutional knowledge. And you are telling a man or a woman how long they can be in a particular job.
All right. Yeah. It's And then I counter with a career politician. This is one of the fields where our polar opposites may not be as far apart as we think. I mean, just say you are against term limits. And there have been times that perhaps I was against it as well, too. But for the sake of the argument, let me say that, yes, we don't. All right. You know, I'll do what you've done, which is I'll take your side and say maybe we don't want 90-year-old senators.
We have had many notable lawmakers, and we can throw in Dianne Feinstein there. She was an old woman. She was a good senator from the state of California. I didn't agree with her policies, but I always felt that she was very, very polite, very productive, and carried herself with the appropriate amount of decorum. Benjamin Franklin died at his desk in the Capitol Rotunda. We had a Zebulon Vance here in North Carolina, was a congressman who died at his desk in the Rotunda in Washington, D.C. So I don't have a problem with folks serving until they're very aged, but it's up to the voters in North Carolina or Washington or California to decide that I'm not going to vote for this person again. I don't really know of any other industry or career where just based simply on your tenure that you were told you can't do that anymore.
The incumbent always has an advantage. I mean, certainly they've got the name recognition. They've got a public record that they can draw upon. Even at the local level, I run across this and counter that with how can we expect these people who have been in a position, perhaps, as I say, removed from the culture, that they are still, after 16 years, can be considered an innovative energy generator, an innovative idea generator.
Having done the rat race in Washington, D.C., at the Pentagon, and also on the legislative side, it takes a special kind of person to want to run for Congress, to want to run for president, to want to be a senator for 6 years. I don't see hundreds of people running down to file for office every year. I mean, there are many races, even at the local level, where you can't get someone to want to serve on the school board.
Yes.
And so if that incumbent is term limited out, then is that position going to go vacant? Is the governor going to have to appoint someone rather than letting the electorate choose because no one wants to run?
And I myself, I wasn't intending to run for Congress, but I looked up what the filing fee for Congress is, and it's like over $1,000. It's like $1,730 or something along that line.
It's usually a percentage. I ran for school board here in Gates County, North Carolina, a couple of cycles ago. And I believe it was 10% of whatever the wage was. And school board where I live pays $50 a month. You've really got to want to do it. You're going to lose money going to a school board once a month when you're only getting paid $50 to be there. It doesn't cover your gas, let alone your time. So you would really need someone who's motivated at all levels. And who would want to go live in Washington, D.C. for 9 months out of the year? For 40 years when you're from New Mexico. I don't see the term career politician really playing out in reality. Dianne Feinstein, Zebulon Vance, Benjamin Franklin, those are really the outliers. And most lawmakers, men and women, leave when they have another opportunity or it's appropriate.
All right. We've been talking with Phil Kiever. His most recent book, or a reissue of his book, 182 Days in Iraq, is available now on Amazon. And Phil, I always enjoy our discussions. And you know, I love you, man.
I still hate your guts.
All right, Phil, I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.
Listen, let me ask you something right at the top. What language do you speak? Think about that for a second. there are things we know about racists. There's no such thing as an intelligent racist, and they probably never set foot out of their own country, sometimes their own state. Do you know who Steve Jobs' biological father was, or who Alan Kurdi was? One-third, that's 95 out of almost 300 Americans, one-third of all U.S. Nobel Prizes in the sciences have been earned by immigrants. 51% of all American billion-dollar startups are created by immigrants. No one who has traveled beyond their shores holds the view of isolationism. Pop quiz here. Did we win world wars during slavery or after we integrated blacks, Navajo, Japanese? We won World War II because we welcomed immigrants into the Manhattan Project. What if those immigrants weren't brown? A former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, pushed thousands of Irish visas just before he resigned, all while blocking immigration reform. Did Jesus turn refugees aside, or did he welcome the stranger? What color was Jesus? Many sports figures are immigrants. Tell me we don't collectively have the best athletes in the world. Rupert Murdoch is an immigrant. Melania Trump is an immigrant. Elon Musk, Ted Cruz, Madeleine Albright, Arianna Huffington, John Muir, Irving Berlin, Andrew Carnegie, Bob Hope, Eddie Van Halen, Joni Mitchell, Gloria Estefan, Natalie Portman, Sofia Vergara, Padma Lakshmi, Schwarzenegger, Einstein, Tesla, Levi Strauss. The inventor of blue jeans was an immigrant. Growing up in a Navy town, I relished the customs, food, dress, dance, celebrations, and family strength that were brought from around the world into my community. My life is richer for them, and now I feel isolated whenever I am without them. More voices means more ideas. The most prosperous communities are the most blended. I seek them out and feel most at home where I am most connected. America's strength is its embrace of diversity, and that diversity that embraces America. 1,000 ideas, the best rising to the top. When you get a chance, look up the phrase immigrant paradox. Immigrants regularly outperform in numerous ways. They are healthier. They put an emphasis on education. They have lower crime statistics, not wanting to draw attention to themselves. They often pay taxes they will never benefit from. All this in spite of the resistance of reactionaries. The U.S. birth rate has dropped below replacement rate. Why are U.S. families doing that? Without immigration, our nation loses 2,000 people per day. What is your favorite meal? Did you invent that? Do you use Arabic numerals? Now, what language do you speak? Not American? What happened to species that don't evolve? Are you better off staying in the cave? When you take a DNA test, does it say you're from North America? Now tell me where I'm wrong.